A new report shows Britain's arms sales to Saudi Arabia since the start of its war on Yemen was 3 times higher than previously announced. South Africa says it plans to deploy up to 25,000 soldiers to quell days of deadly unrest amid fears of food and fuel shortages. Also ahead, concerns are growing in the US and Europe as the number of coronavirus infections is once again on the rise. Welcome to World News. We're live from the Iranian capital, Tehran. Thank you very much for joining us. Our top story this hour, Britain has reportedly exported around 3 times the amount of weaponry and military equipment to Saudi Arabia than it previously announced. A recent investigation by the Campaign Against Arms Trade shows British officials have used a loophole in the country's so-called transparent export controls. The report says the move intends to hide the real extent of the UK's contribution to the Saudi aggression against Yemen. While authorities claim British ministers signed off £6.7 billion worth of arms sales, the probe says the true figure is likely to be closer to £20 billion. Meanwhile, the UK's Department for International Trade, which approves all arms exports, has not disputed the findings of the study. Saudi Arabia launched a war on Yemen in March 2015. Tens of thousands of people, mostly civilians, have lost their lives since then. Political commentator Michael Springman says Britain claims to be the cradle of democracy while in fact it is hiding its arms sales to states such as Saudi Arabia.
Well, it's bad publicity for the British and their terrible claim to being the mother of democracies and having the mother of all parliaments. When in fact what they're doing is hiding their sales to terrorist states like Saudi Arabia. The British get away with this by having something called an open export license for weapons. And you can sell weapons over 3 to a 5 year period, but you needn't put the exact amount of the sale down. It can be blank. And this is how they get away with it in typical British perfidy. They say one thing and do another, and they believe that they are clean as the driven snow, when in fact they're dirty as a bunch of coal dust. So it's pure Britishness, and it makes money for Her Majesty's government.
The United Arab Emirates has inaugurated its embassy in Israel as part of a deal to normalize ties signed between the two sides, Mona Kandil reports from the occupied West Bank.
Following Israel's inauguration of its embassy in the United Arab Emirates, the Arab Kingdom opened its embassy in Tel Aviv, situated in the Stock Exchange building. The Palestinians were outraged by the UAE's decision to establish ties with Israel, and now opening of its embassy in Tel Aviv means that the UAE has chosen to disavow the Palestinians' rights and collaborate with the occupying regime instead of boycotting it.
The UAE's move is part of the normalization deal between the two sides and comes at a time when Israel has escalated its atrocities against the Palestinians. We expect the war to boycott the Israeli regime and pressurize it into stopping its crimes against the Palestinian people.
The flag-raising ceremony was attended by the UAE Ambassador Mohammed Al-Khaja, as well as Israeli President Ishaq Herzog, who called the opening of the embassy an important milestone in Israel's journey towards the future, peace, prosperity, and security for the Middle East.
This move will help the Israeli regime to go further with its crimes against Palestinians. We hope that the latest war on Gaza could open the eyes of the Arab states on the true nature of Israel. Signing any agreement with Israel is in favor of the occupation regime's expansionist and aggressive ambitions.
Last month, Israeli Foreign Minister paid a landmark visit to the UAE and opened an embassy in Abu Dhabi and a consulate in Dubai. The UAE was the first of 4 Arab countries to agree to normalize ties with Israel last year under the so-called Abraham Accords, a pact brokered by former U.S. President Donald Trump. Bahrain, Morocco, and Sudan signed normalization deals with the Israeli regime shortly afterwards. By opening its embassy in Tel Aviv, Palestinians say the United Arab Emirates continues to reward the Israeli regime and giving up the Holy Lands. They call the UAE's latest normalization move treason. Mona Kandil, occupied Ramallah.
Well, the Palestinian resistance movement Hamas has slammed the United Arab Emirates for opening its embassy in Israel, calling the move a stab in the back of the Palestinians.
The UAE move to open an embassy within the occupation of the state is an insistence on the national scene it committed by signing the normalization agreement. This behavior is certainly harmful to the Palestinian cause and serves the narrative of the occupation. It constitutes a stab in the back of our Palestinian people and the resistance that fought the Battle of Sword of Al-Quds.
The Hamas spokesman called on the UAE to cancel its normalization deal with the Israeli regime brokered by Washington last year. The opening of the embassy also drew condemnation from other Palestinian factions. The Palestinian Islamic Jihad movement called the normalization with Israel a betrayal, a crime, and an ignorance of the truth. The movement said the UAE's move would be recorded in history as it comes at the height of Israel's crimes against the Palestinians. The West Bank-based Fatah movement also decried the opening of the UAE embassy in Israel and called for the expulsion of Abu Dhabi from the Arab League. Iran's foreign minister has criticized the United States for its sanctions regime, saying Washington never achieved its desired goals with anti-Tehran measures. Mohammad Javad Zarif made the comments in his Twitter post on the sixth anniversary of the signing of the Iran nuclear deal. Pointing to stances of different American administrations, Zarif said former President Barack Obama had realized his crippling sanctions would, quote, not cripple Iran and its centrifuges. He added that Obama's successor, Donald Trump, also failed to do so, despite thinking that his maximum pressure would work against Iran. A chart addressed to the current U.S. president, the top Iranian diplomat, urged Joe Biden to carefully look at these statistics. The United States withdrew from the Iran nuclear deal in 2018 and reimposed sanctions on the Islamic Republic.
On July 14, 2015, Iran and the world powers, which included the U.S., the U.K., France, Germany, Russia, and China, reached a deal on Iran's peaceful nuclear energy program. The deal, which has come to be known as the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, puts limits on Iran's nuclear program in exchange for lifting illegal sanctions imposed on Tehran. The removal of sanctions was celebrated in Iran as Iranian officials tried to drum up investment for the country's sanctions-battered economy. One of the main pillars of the JCPOA was a mutual positive attitude of the parties involved. But despite Iran's strict adherence to the deal and the fulfillment of its obligations, the U.S., under the administration of ex-President Barack Obama, failed to fully keep its side of the bargain. Even after the deal was signed, Iran was not capable of enjoying the full benefits of the deal, since the U.S. sanctions haunted other countries, with the U.S. threatening anyone wanting to do business with Iran. While the U.S. government had agreed to lift the nuclear sanctions against Iran, it continued to impose other sanctions on Iran over what it described as Tehran's human rights policies and its alleged support for terrorism. When Donald Trump became the U.S. president, he pulled Washington out of the deal as part of his so-called maximum pressure strategy against Iran. On May 8, 2018, he appeared in front of cameras and officially terminated the U.S.'s participation in the deal in order to kill the agreement.
This is the whole problem. We could spend a lot of time sitting around talking about, well, this aspect of the deal or that aspect of the deal, and whether this is fair or whether that is good. But the question is, it's irrelevant because they're not the people who have the power to enforce it. They can negotiate an agreement, and as soon as someone comes in, they can simply say, no, we're not going to follow it, which is what Trump did.
Back then, the administration of President Hassan Rouhani and his team came under fire from critics for failing to get the necessary guarantees in order to levy penalties on the U.S. for violating the deal.
And what is the latest on the JCPOA or the Iran nuclear deal? The U.S. says the talks on its revival will continue in mid-August, but the ball is in Iran's court to decide on the outcome. Iran, meanwhile, has said that the talks will not lead to any agreement since the U.S. has not agreed to remove all sanctions in a verifiable way. There has also been strong domestic opposition in Iran. especially from Parliament, on the way the negotiations took place. Taking into account all these developments, the chances of success of the talks remain very slim.
Despite U.S. administration's official pullout from the JCPOA, Iran continued to implement the agreement. The European side pledged to do business with Iran through a mechanism which came to be known as the Instrument in Support of Trade Exchanges, or INSTEX. But the project ultimately failed due to the inaction of the European side and the U.S. pressure, leaving Iran with no option but to scale back its JCPOA commitments within the limits of the deal. The new U.S. administration, under President Biden, has pledged to revive the deal. However, Biden appears to follow the failed policies of his predecessor. It appears that the Biden administration is planning to remove certain sanctions, but to keep a number of sanctions against Iran so that the talks may move toward non-nuclear issues. The U.S. is reportedly dividing the post-JCPOA sanctions into JCPOA-related and non-JCPOA-related ones, intending to remove only the former.
Given years of serious violations of JCPOA by other sides, it is essential to secure enough assurances that all sanctions are removed verifiably, and the U.S. will not, once again, withdraw from the JCPOA or abuse its mechanism to create another implementation crisis to deprive Iran of its benefits from the deal.
But Iran is saying that it considers all those sanctions as JCPOA-related because they were imposed with the intent to affect the deal and its implementation. Almost recently, the negotiations to revive it.
So what you have is a situation where basically you have Trump in office, who then overturns the Democratic JCPOA, the one that they created. Democrats come into office with Biden, and you think the first thing they would do would be to overturn what Trump did. Well, if it's not as crucial to this group of people, then it gets overturned. But this doesn't get overturned because the people in charge are not Biden and they're not Trump.
Iran says the idea of classifying the sanctions into removable, negotiable, and non-removable is seriously at odds with attempts to revive the deal. Iran says the Biden administration must have a formal and international commitment that the White House will not withdraw from the deal again.
The Taliban have raised their traditional flag above a key border post between Afghanistan and Pakistan. In recent weeks, the militants have made rapid advances across the country, seizing a series of border posts from Afghan forces, including crossings with Iran, Tajikistan, and Turkmenistan. Javid Rana has more from Islamabad.
This is one of the key crossing points between Afghanistan and Pakistan. Now this border crossing, which divides Afghan town of Spin Baldock in Kandahar province on one side and Pakistani town of Chaman on other, is effectively under the control of Afghan Taliban. Taliban reportedly took the crossing with no resistance. This is the second busiest crossing between two countries. The crossing takeover would be a major prize symbolically and strategically if the Taliban's continue to hold it. The government in Kabul has denied Taliban's takeover, although pictures on the social media show the militants have seized the crossing.
The Afghan forces, which were trained by the US and NATO, seem to be falling like house of cards. Capturing of this crossing point, the latest one, is a symbol and a symbolic message to Pakistan that Pakistan has to recognize the reality of Taliban, and Taliban can overtake the entire Afghanistan by force, and this time around there is no resistance at all.
In recent weeks, Taliban recaptured districts after districts, many of them without resistance, after they announced a general amnesty for the Afghan National Army and security forces. The Taliban claim that they have now recaptured 85% of Afghan territory. They have already taken over several other crossing points along with Afghanistan's borders with Iran, Tajikistan, and Turkmenistan.
If military confrontation between the Afghan sides persists, we foresee deeper instability, economic meltdown, a fresh wave of refugee influx in neighboring countries. Can we afford to look the other way? while our neighbor Afghanistan faces stiffer challenges?
Afghan President Ashraf Ghani has vowed on what he called the Taliban's backbone will be broken and the lost territories would be won back. The Taliban's territorial gains have come amid stepped-up U.S. withdrawal from Afghanistan after two decades of war and occupation. Analysts believe that recent sequence of events demonstrate that the U.S. legacy for Afghanistan may be a continued sense of insecurity and conflict in the region. Javed Rana, Islamabad.
Turning elsewhere now, South Africa plans to deploy up to 25,000 soldiers in two provinces where security forces are struggling to quell days of unrest. South Africa's Defence and Military Veterans Minister told a parliamentary committee that he has submitted a request for the deployment. Meanwhile, authorities announced that the security forces have arrested 1,754 people in connection with days of looting, arson and violence. The unrest stokes fears of food and fuel shortages amid disruptions in several key industries. The crisis that engulfed South Africa after former President Jacob Zuma was jailed 6 days ago has left more than 70 people dead. Well, we're going to turn to some coronavirus news now. Infections are on the rise in Europe and the United States, with the highly transmissible Delta variant contributing significantly to the recent surge. Spain has reported more than 43,000 new cases. The Spanish northeastern region of Catalonia, a hotbed of the Delta variant, has now reintroduced restrictions and curfews in an attempt to contain the virus. The United Kingdom has reported 50 new coronavirus fatalities, the highest daily death tally since April. The number of new daily cases has also topped 30,000 for the seventh day in a row. In the world's worst hit country, the United States, the rate of new cases has seen at least a 10% hike in 46 states. Some states have even seen a 50% jump in the number of infections in the past week. Meanwhile, clashes have erupted between French riot police and anti-vaccination protesters in the capital, Paris. The demonstrators were voicing their anger at President Emmanuel Macron's COVID-19 plan, which will be put in effect next month. The plan will require a vaccine certificate or negative test to grant access to public places, including restaurants and cinemas. A similar protest was held in the Greek capital, Athens. And that brings an end to our bulletin for this hour, but don't go away.
Follow us on social media to stay up to date on the latest global developments. You can keep in touch with us by following us on Twitter at twitter.com/ParsTodayEN. You can also follow IRIB English Radio on Instagram via instagram.com/ParsTodayEnglish.
In the limelight.
Palestinians have rarely been afforded a voice in Western and especially American news outlets, says Amal Haddad Ryder in an article published under the heading, Gaza is still under attack, but you wouldn't know it from Western media. Stay tuned for the details of this article, please. In mid-May, as the Israeli regime military pummeled the Gaza Strip with shattering force, a medical student in southern city of Rafah sent a plea to a friend, who shared it with another friend, who shared it with the nation. The student's name was Noor al-Shire, and she was desperate to speak up, for our voices to be heard, for our story to be out, as she wrote. I have lived through three heinous wars only to live up to fourth. That already feels worse than all the previous three piled up together, she continued. Safety is not an option in the strip, and it hurts me so much reading the news on the Western media, seeing how the stories are all one-sided. For two brief years, Al-Shire studied neuroscience at Washington and Lee University in Virginia, but she had to return home during the COVID-19 pandemic. The Zionist regime did not allow Al-Shire to leave the strip to return to school. Palestinians must apply for a permit to leave Gaza and are rejected more often than not. So she enrolled in medical school in Gaza. During the 11 days of the Israeli regime's latest bombing of Gaza, the regime's airstrikes killed 256 Palestinians, including 66 children, while over 72,000 Gazans were made homeless. While the two sides agreed to a ceasefire, the violence faced by Palestinians has not ceased in the West Bank, Al-Quds, occupied territories, or, of course, in Gaza. There, in the besieged strip, people are not only struggling with the aftermath of the onslaught, but also with ongoing bombing. As Al-Shire said, the ceasefire doesn't mean that the Israeli regime stopped activities in Gaza. 2 days ago, they sent around 10 quadcopters aircraft to the strip. That's breaking the ceasefire, but who cares? Nobody cares. Nobody listens to us. And she noted, nobody, above all not the media, stays focused on Palestine when the bombs stop falling. When the media stops talking about Palestine, we think of it as the win for the Israeli regime. What a lot of people fail to understand is that the ceasefire does not mean life is perfect now. Before the attacks, it was already miserable. The blockade has been imposed on Gaza since 2007. The Israeli regime counts the calories that come into the strip and decides how much food Palestinians are allowed to eat. This is apartheid. It should not be acceptable. Palestinians have rarely been afforded a voice in Western and especially American news outlets. Al-Shire said, now the people know they actually need to force their governments to impose sanctions and withdraw all funding from the Israeli regime. That's tax money being used, and since it's a democracy, they should have a say in where their money goes. I think a lot of Americans are still missing BDS. BDS would make a lot of difference and actually impose sanctions on the Israeli regime and change the reality for the Palestinians. It would get us much closer to our freedom and getting our rights back and stopping the killing of Palestinians. I think some people are lost. What with all the allegations and attacks on BDS that call it anti-Semitic? But there is always going to be attacks against what we say in Palestine. It's time for them to actually believe us, she added. The resilience of people in Gaza is absolutely amazing, Al-Shire said. After the ceasefire was declared, we'd lost so many lives. People lost their homes. I lost my pregnant cousin with her child. Her other son is alive. He lost his mom and sister, but he just made it. We lost people we care about, but as soon as the ceasefire was declared, we all came into the streets. We missed aid because aid was during the attacks. So we started doing takbir for aid, like Allahu Akbar. During the attacks, the night time was always the worst. There is always more bombing during the night. We got used to staying up late, and the night of the ceasefire, everybody left their houses wearing their aid clothes. The next day, I saw people all wearing aid outfits going to the sea and to parks. One moment, we were all at risk of being killed at any second. And now everybody is just moving on. It's just amazing. The second thing is that even though we were actively being attacked, people were okay with us being attacked. If it meant we were standing in solidarity with the people in Al-Quds. Every time I think about it, I'm amazed. We knew that we would be killed at any second, but if it meant that we are at least taking some of this really regime's power away from Al-Quds to be with us, we were fine with it.
Food for thought.
Hello, dear listeners, and since we're still basking in the blessed wedding anniversary celebrations of Imam Ali ibn Abi Talib and Hazrat Fatima Zahra, peace be upon them, here is what Prophet Muhammad, blessings of God upon him and his progeny, said when solemnizing the nuptials of his immaculate daughter and his infallible son-in-law. May Allah bless you, prosper you, and produce much good from you.
Is there any other way to get familiar with Islam besides mainstream media? Try IRIB English Radio. log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/EM.
This is A to Z. An introduction to Islamic lifestyle. Today's lesson, respect of freedom of thought. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. In the name of Allah, the most beneficent, the most merciful. Dissimulation and concealment of one's ideas and beliefs usually arises when a selfish majority of society prevents the righteous minority from expressing their thoughts freely. Surely such a society will not be prosperous. In an Islamic and humanitarian society, the righteous people should have the freedom to disclose their viewpoints for public comments and discourse. No one should hinder them. Instead, there should be respect for freedom of thought and reformative thinking, and facilities should be provided for imparting training and bringing ideas to fruition. Prophet Muhammad sallallahu alaihi wasallam said, "When a believer is forced to hide his beliefs, he is living among bad people." Brothers and sisters, 1400 years ago, living amongst maybe very low intellectual minded people, people who could not really propose and bring up new ideas, Prophet Muhammad sallallahu alaihi wasallam said this golden saying. And hence, based on this, we can see that this divine messenger, Prophet Muhammad, he knew what's to come. He knew that humanity is going to get to a point where they would have creative and beneficial ideas. And hence, the ground needs to be plowed and needs to be prepared for such individuals, such believers who are going to express those progressive ideas in future. At that point, Prophet Muhammad sallallahu alaihi wasallam probably didn't have the target audience for that high level discussions, but today, alhamdulillah, we see in our societies that we have a need and urge for expressing those progressive and high level ideas and concepts. Welcome back, dear listeners. Today we are discussing the respect for freedom of thought. Sometimes, you know, people think that, oh, it's the West that just came up with freedom of speech and freedom of expression and freedom of thought. No, 1400 years ago, Prophet Muhammad sallallahu alaihi wasallam laid the foundations of this attitude of allowing the believers and those who are better than us to be able to express new ideas and concepts, and they should be open to criticism, to dissection, to analysis, to evaluation. So it is really Islam that has provided that ground for people to be able to express new ideas. It is important and essential for the progress and development of humanity. And Prophet Muhammad knew it. You know, when it comes to creative freedom, unfortunately, even today, when we look at, you know, the overall environment, we don't feel that there is creative freedom being provided to the believers, to the mu'mineen, to be able to express themselves. And this is contrary to what Prophet Muhammad had said 1400 years ago. So the believers, those who have genius ideas, which may be out of the box, nobody has brought them up so far, they should be given the field to be able to express their ideas and be corrected if those ideas are not in line with Islam, corrected through arguments. Then there is a room for improvement everywhere, in every case, in every scenario. If we don't have respect for freedom of thought, then how do we expect to improve? And if we are satisfied with what we have, then there's a bigger problem we are facing. We're not even realizing that that development has slowed down and in some cases ceased within the Islamic world. So this whole idea of being open and accepting of new thoughts is something that needs to be put in place and exercised in Islamic societies. Dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, thank you very much for staying with us till the end of today's episode of A to Z. Don't forget to log on to our website at www.parstoday.com, Call of Islam page. We leave you all in the care of Allah. Till next time, wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
The issue of marine trash has long worried scientists and environmentalists. Now a French engineer has invented a robot to help clean ocean waste. The Jellyfish Bot is a remote-controlled electric-powered boat that helps clean rubbish from the surface of the water. It's 70 centimeters long and 70 wide, almost the size of a suitcase. The robot can collect everything from plastic bottles to masks and even oil and petrol. Despite its wide-ranging utility, Jellyfish Bot has a rather simple mechanism.
To collect trash, you have to do something as simple as possible, because otherwise, if we put too complicated mechanisms, it can get blocked and things can get stuck in the system. We designed the robot with a slide mechanism that goes towards a net, so we fill up the net, we take back the net, and that's the end of it.
The trash collecting robot is being used at around 15 ports in France, lightening the workload of local cleaners. It has also been exported to countries including Japan, Norway, and Singapore. The makers have also developed an autonomous version of the boat.
Malaysians at a vaccination center in the city of Kuching have witnessed a surprising scene. A T-Rex turned up to get his COVID-19 jab. Fitness instructor Kenny Sia dressed up in a dinosaur costume to amuse people, doesn't he look fabulous, and protect himself. Sia said he made the decision to lift up the spirits of frontline health workers, is exhausted by vaccinating over 5,000 people a day. People rushed to take pictures with him, hailing his appearance and historic. Funny. A A giant 3D cat has risen to fame in the Japanese capital, Tokyo, bringing joy to citizens amid the COVID-19 pandemic. A massive billboard featuring the cat has been installed in one of Tokyo's busiest districts. The realistic-looking cat on a 4K resolution screen appears every few minutes between advertisements. Depending on the time of day, the cat appears differently and sometimes meowing at people walking by. The companies that set up the billboard hope that they can cheer people up during the dark era of the coronavirus pandemic. The display has already caused a frenzy in the city and among the social platforms, with many expressing joy and amazement at the technology.
Peru is full of natural wonders worthy of appreciation in each of its regions. A zoo in the capital, Lima, has now unveiled an incredibly cute and adorable Andean alpaca calf to attract visitors amid dwindling zoo goers due to the coronavirus pandemic. This very baby alpaca, named Paquita, is just 1 month old and was introduced to the public on the eve of the 200th anniversary of Peru's independence from Spain. The zoo has also displayed its families of llamas, alpaca, and vicuña. The three are members of South American camelids biological family and are traditionally valued for their soft and warm wool. They live in the Andes Mountains, which lay thousands of meters above sea level. Peruvians are proud of the history of wools associated with these species, which have common ancestors with camels.
Four German tightrope walkers have set a new world highlining distance record by crossing an Arctic valley in Sweden. The group tiptoed a distance of more than 2 kilometers between two mountain peaks in Lapland barefoot. The line they walked on was set at a height of 600 meters. The four members of the team walked the line one after another successfully, despite challenges including the wind and long distance. It took 2 days for the team to rig the line between the two peaks.
A herd of elephants migrating in China have been making headlines for months. Now they have once again attracted attention. Experts monitoring the animals this week noticed two females engaged in a dramatic fight over the herd's leadership, where they kicked and bit each other. The tussle soon ended after a male elephant succeeded in calming the belligerent giants. The fight happened in China's southwestern province of Yunnan. The herd embarked on a lengthy journey last year after escaping a nature reserve and has since trekked hundreds of miles. The elephant's migration is the longest one in China's history.
A distinctive feature, no matter of humans or animals, often catches our attention. You might have heard stories about the big fat cow or other animals you love the most. Here we bring you a story about a cow for her not being big, but for being the smallest. Rani, a 23-month-old cow, is being reared on a farm near the Bangladeshi capital, Dhaka. She is only 20 inches tall and weighs 26 kilograms. Local vets say the little Rani has no physical problems but will no longer gain any weight or height. The owner believes Rani is shorter than the smallest cow in Guinness World Record. The record for the smallest cow so far held by a 4-year-old red cow named Manikyam from the Indian state of Kerala.
We found on the internet that the smallest known cow is living in India's Kerala, which weighs 40 kilograms, but ours weighs only 26, so we believe ours is the world's smallest. That's why we applied to the Guinness World Records. They replied to us saying they will investigate within 90 days.
The tiny cow has also caused tourist frenzy in the South Asian country as thousands are flocking to Dhaka to take a glance despite coronavirus restrictions. The owner says only over 15,000 people come to visit her in just 3 days. The dwarf cow has also gone viral on social media. A nearly 22-meter-high sand sculpture in Denmark has set a new Guinness record as the world's tallest sandcastle. The sculpture has been constructed with nearly 5 tons of sand. It's made in the shape of a triangle, and a wood structure stabilizes it. More than 30 artists from different countries have worked on the project, carving intricate details on the castle's wall. Its makers say a nod to the coronavirus pandemic was also made at the top of that construction. They say that's because the virus has controlled the lives of people over the past months. The sand piece broke the previous Guinness record that belonged to an 18-meter-high sand castle in Germany.
The Light is a short bulletin in which we bring you a lot of interesting news in different fields like animals' life, cultural events, funny trending news, and more from every corner of the world.
An adorable baby elephant has become a web celebrity after she was caught on camera using a muddy hill as playground slide. Footage shows the little elephant excitedly approaching a hill with a smooth path leading downward. The baby then goes on all fours to have the time of her life sliding on her belly down the hill, taking full advantage of rain. The toddler, named Yishong, is only 3 years old. She lives at a rescue center in China, one of the major habitats for wild Asian elephants in the country.
A French company has taken the process of pizza making to a whole new level by creating a robot chef. The robot named Patsy is completely autonomous. The machine, now working in a pizzeria in Paris, is capable of taking orders, making a pizza from scratch and serving it. Having three arms, the robot can make 120 pizzas in an hour, which is 13 times faster than a human chef.
We are in a very fast process with a perfect control of time and quality, since we have a constancy offered by robotics and then an environment that is quite cool and relaxed. The idea is also to spend a few pleasant minutes washing the robot while you wait for your pizza to be made.
It took designers 8 years to develop the machine, which is claimed to be the first pizza-making robot in the world. They hope to use the technology to open robotics-run restaurants that can function round the clock. In China, scientists are happy that the world's first artificially bred leaf monkey is doing well 2.5 months after being born. The rare monkey was born at a research and protection center in Wuzhou City in April. Its birth took place several days earlier than the due date, and the baby was relatively weak at birth. However, thanks to its parents and caretakers, it has grown in a normal way. Scientists say the baby monkey is now in a good condition and its behavior is totally normal.
It is very important in terms of the cytic value. It has been growing abnormally. In addition, we have found that it has a curiosity about the world and always shows some exploratory and learning behaviors. In general, it is in very good physical condition.
The center's scientists say another leaf monkey that was born in April is doing well too. These monkeys are the 8th generation of leaf monkeys that have been bred in captivity. Their successful births have raised hope amongst the scientists of saving a species that is one of China's most endangered wild animals. imagine the hungriest you've ever been. How many hot dogs could you possibly gobble down in 10 minutes? An American man has done 76. Professional eater Joey Chestnut broke the world record in the International Hot Dog Eating Contest on Brooklyn's Coney Island. The 37-year-old managed to devour the first 30 hot dogs in only 3 minutes. The impressive win marked his 14th victory at the annual contest. He held the previous record, which was only one sausage sandwich, less than his 2021 record. Astronauts at China's space station have successfully carried out the country's first spacewalk. Two astronauts exited the core module of Tiangong to examine the station's robotic arm. They also elevated a panoramic camera and tested new generation spacesuits. The mission lasted 7 hours. According to the China Manned Space Agency, another spacewalk will be conducted soon. In June, three Chinese astronauts blasted off to become the first crew of the Tiangong station. They will remain there for 3 months. Lionel Messi is one of the most popular football players with millions of fans from across the world, but the legendary player enjoys special love and affection in his hometown. Local artists at Rosario relished the chance to honor Messi in a mural on a four-story building. The 14-meter-high and 8-meter-wide giant artwork stands opposite of the school Messi attended in his childhood. The mural depicts him as both an adult and a child. Messi had been the top scorer in European football leagues multiple times. He also received the world's best player award for a record 6 times. The 34-year-old currently holds the Argentinian national team's captaincy. Pangolins might look tough with their scaly armor, but they are in fact highly vulnerable animals. A Vietnamese man is dedicating his time and energy to making sure they are safe. 39-year-old Thai has been protecting pangolins since his boyhood when he saw one brutally hunted by his neighbors. The bitter experience inspired him to find or make a group devoted to saving the endangered species. Save Vietnam's Wildlife has over 60 staff and has so far rescued around 1,600 pangolins. Thai says seeing the rescued animals return to nature is the best part of his job.
The most wonderful moments in the lives of all of the conservationists at my center are the moments that we witness the rescued pangolins getting out from the transportation cages and slowly walking into the forest, because the forest is their true home, where they can have the joy of living their lives in their own way.
Pangolins are one of the most trafficked mammals in the world. Their number have fallen due to illegal trade. The animals, now critically endangered, could once be found in the rainforests across Asia and Africa. They use their sticky tongues to hunt for ants, termites, and similar prey. The pandemic has not stopped this British musician from holding live concerts. His audience is a very special group in Danish rural areas. Jacob Shaw, a university professor, is the man behind this experiment. He says playing for the animals has been his second best option after the pandemic forced the cancellation of many events and social gatherings. Shaw says the performance for the cows has been so rewarding that he wants to continue it even after public spaces are reopened. He says the cows seem to enjoy classical music very much.
They react differently to different pieces. We played something that was slightly more upbeat, a little bit more modern, and a lot of them didn't like it and they went away. And I think that the type of pieces which is closer to their voice, closer to their mooing, which could be similar actually to a cello, which is why it's so successful with them, they prefer that.
The cello player is sometimes accompanied by other musicians. They say the experience has helped them practice and also relieve some of the stress of a live concert.
A diverse range of programs. Youth. Spirituality. Culture. Eastern Tales. Roundtable discussions. Politics. All produced by IRIB English Radio. Our website is www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
As governments in multiple EU states struggle to curb an increasingly alarming surge in COVID-19 cases, the Dutch Premier Mark Rutte has apologized and conceded that restrictions reinstated this weekend were lifted too soon. Meanwhile, the French President Emmanuel Macron unveiled a raft of new measures on Monday, 12th of July, including making health certificates mandatory in cafes and restaurants and on planes and long-distance trains from next month. The article you're about to hear has been written by The Guardian's Europe correspondent John Henley. The piece is titled, Dutch PM Sorry for Early Reopening as France Tightens COVID Rules. As governments in multiple European Union states struggle to curb an increasingly alarming surge in COVID-19 cases, the Dutch Prime Minister Mark Rutte has apologized and conceded that restrictions reinstated this weekend were lifted too soon. Meanwhile, France's President Emmanuel Macron unveiled a raft of new measures on Monday, 12th of July, including making health certificates mandatory in cafes and restaurants, and on planes and long-distance trains from next month. While cases are rising, hospital admissions in most EU countries have not so far followed the same curve, prompting officials to suggest that, as vaccination campaigns advance, hospital data should become a bigger factor in responding to the pandemic. Dutch Premier Mark Rutte last week reimposed curbs on restaurants and nightclubs in the Netherlands, and cancelled all events involving large crowds until at least 14th of August, as new cases rose almost sevenfold, from a rolling seven-day average of 49 for every million people on 4th of July to nearly 330 at the weekend. What we thought would be possible turned out not to be in practice, he said on Monday. We had poor judgment, which we regret and which we apologize. At least 30 event organizers have launched joint legal proceedings over the U-turn. The Dutch Health Minister, Hugo de Jong, said last week that holidays could be affected by the surge, but he was hopeful that other European Union countries would look at hospital data rather than infections when debating quarantine or test requirements on Dutch travelers. 2 weeks ago, all